This is Focus 580, the second hour of our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a sociologist who is well known for work that she has done in the area of youth development. Her name is Karen Pittman, and she is executive director of the Forum for Youth Investment in Washington, D.C. She's here visiting the campus. She was here and gave a talk in a series, occasional series, and we've had many of these speakers here on the program, in fact, sponsored by the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program. She gave a talk last night on the campus, and we're pleased that she could be here to talk a little bit with us about the same subject area, and that is, broadly speaking, how it is over time we have changed the way we think about trying to work with disadvantaged young people. And she would argue that there has been a significant and important change in the way that we have done that. And we'll talk about that. Questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. You want to talk just a little bit about the Forum for Youth Investment and what that's all about?
I will try, and I'll try to be brief. The Forum for Youth Investment is a national nonprofit. We call ourselves an action tank. We really work to bridge research, policy, practice, and advocacy to bring the best of what we know about what it takes for young people to grow and develop into all of those arenas. We spend a lot of time working with states and communities, but we also work at the national level with policymakers and national organizations that range from the National Governors Association to the Association of School Administrators.
Okay. Just to make the basic point, and I think it's an interesting one, that how it is that, say, over the past several decades, we have changed this this approach to how it is that we deal with what is it we're trying to do to help young people, disadvantaged young people, at risk youth. What, you know, all those labels that we slap on these poor kids. And as I understand it, the important shift is going from really talking about problems and negatives to trying to do an approach that says, well, maybe instead of spending so much time talking about deficits, maybe it might not be such a bad idea to talk about assets and try to shift to a more positive kind of focus. And maybe you can give it, because you know you've been involved in doing this work for a long time, you can give a little bit of an historical perspective on this.
Right. I think we still have work to do. So this is this is something that's changing and not changed. But to use that overused phrase of paradigm shift, there really has been over the past decade or so a shift in thinking. At the Forum, we really try hard to deal in sound bites. And so the shift, as we talk about it, is a shift significant because we can say problem-free isn't fully prepared. In other words, if I sit down and I say, here's a young person, here's David. He's 18 years old. He's not a high school dropout. He's not a teen father. He's not a gang member. He doesn't abuse substances. Will you hire him? Your answer would be?
Well, I don't know. Maybe. Tell me some more about why I should hire. Don't tell me, you know, that's all well and good, but tell me some reasons why actually I should hire him.
You would say, well, what can he do?
Yeah,
that's fine,
but
what can he do? Yeah. That's the essence of this shift. We can focus on the issues of making sure that young people are not doing things that either risk their lives or risk their futures. But in the end, what we really want to know is, are they ready for college? Are they ready for work? Are they ready for life? Are they ready for citizenship? And so we have spent much more time defining the things that we don't and measuring and tracking the things that we don't want them to do than defining and articulating the things that really are the outcomes, the behaviors, the skills, the attitudes that we want to have that would actually make young people competent and ready. They know that. We know that. Employers know that. There's a recent survey that just came out from a couple of organizations, the Corporate Voices for Working Families and the Partnership for 21st Century Skills, two networks of large employers, have mounted a survey of over 400 employers, from big ones to small and mid-sized employers, asking the question, are they ready for work, using a list of 21st century skills that employers and educators have come to sort of own, that, yes, includes academic competence, reading, writing, and math comprehension, technology and information literacy, but also creativity, communication skills, problem-solving skills, financial literacy, those kinds of things, teamwork that we want young people to have as a full mix of skills and competencies so that they can move into the next set of things to do. This survey found that, yes, employers think these skills are extremely important for high school graduates, for those with some college training, and also for four-year graduates. They found that in all, they thought that 4 out of 10 of the high school graduates who come to them looking for jobs are extremely deficit in these skills, that they just don't have them. And again, at the top of their list wasn't that they can't do advanced calculus, but they don't know how to work it as a team. They don't have a sense of professionalism and work ethic. They don't really know what it means to come to work. They don't have good problem-solving skills or oral and written communication skills, basic things that we think young people need to have to be ready for work. And we're getting the same arguments from colleges and institutions of higher education. The number of young people who come to campus and have to take remedial courses goes up steadily every year. So somehow our focus on academic competence, very narrowly defined, has led to us developing a generation of young people. We can call them disadvantaged, at risk, or whatever. But in part, one of the core things that's wrong is that as a country, we've defined competence for young people so narrowly that they're all at risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I guess one might ask a question that if we think that previous generations were better prepared on along these lines, then one of the questions one might ask was, well, how exactly did that happen? And then what has changed between that time, say, when we were kids, and now today's teenagers?
It's a good question. And we don't really have the data to say that whether it's that we were better prepared before or that the requirements in the 21st century are higher, but mm-hmm. There's no doubt that the gap is there and that employers are feeling it, young people are feeling it. When we poll young people, they don't think they're ready either. So we've got this sense that we're not doing all that we can to get young people prepared and that this narrow focus on making sure that they're not in trouble in various ways isn't enough. We also have the idea that's critically important that those young people who we would label as disadvantaged, at risk, whatever, whether they're not doing well in school or they've dropped out, they're a teen parent, they're court involved, they're in foster care, whatever that population is that we want to say is at risk, we also need to recognize that the issue isn't just getting them up to a minimal level. It's really making sure that they're fully prepared. So the strategies that we bring in can't just be strategies to say, get out of trouble. They have to be strategies that are truly motivating strategies, get out of trouble by making sure that you're really ready to go do what you want to do, because these young people still have aspirations. They may have a gap, but they have aspirations. So one of the things that I think we have found is that we've come to both have an over-reliance on school as the solution, so that we're not really engaging and giving credit to the full set of community institutions that are involved in young people's lives. So thinking about the fact that learning happens everywhere. That's number one. Doesn't just happen in school, and not all learning is best suited to happen in school. Things that are really learned best through experience are in some ways not well simulated in school, but you really need to go out and do it. At some point, you need to try having a job. At some point, you really need to try to do things where the consequences of not doing it well are real and felt. They're not just you got a D on your paper, but something really didn't happen that had consequence. So we know that young people need learning experiences that they can't get in school. We also know, now that we have better graduation rate data, that a surprising number of young people are not in school. We now have data that suggests that only that 30% of young people, 32% of young people, don't graduate from high school on time, that in urban neighborhoods and in minority populations, that number can get up over 50%. So we've got a large number of young people who are not in school. And then we also know that we've got young people who are in school who aren't fully engaged. They're not motivated. They're there. They're marking their time, sitting in their seat, but they're not engaged. That means that if we really want to have a commitment to making sure young people are ready for college, work, and life, we have a commitment that we know that getting them ready means building these skills and competencies. We've got to look more seriously at the range of environments in the community where learning happens and make sure that those environments are known, they're supported, they're recognized, and that young people are getting to them and are getting credit for being in them.
Let me just introduce again our guest, Karen Pittman. She's Executive Director of the Forum for Youth Investment in Washington, D.C. She is a sociologist by her training and has been working in this area of what communities can do to better support young people and how it is that people can work together, young people themselves, all certainly involving schools, but other kinds of community organizations and community leaders and parents, how all those people work together to make communities healthier places for kids to grow up. She's here visiting the campus. She gave a talk last night sponsored by the folks at the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program. She's worked with a number of different organizations in her career, including the Urban Institute and the Children's Defense Fund. She was also worked during the Clinton administration as director of the President's Crime Prevention Council. And questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, it sounds as if what we're talking about here is something that is connected to a larger kind of problem that a lot of people have pointed to, and that is the erosion of the idea of community and the fact that people in their lives, probably all sorts of people, their horizons, their involvement of their community has shrunk, and that institutions that used to provide for that kind of involvement, where people came together, whether it was to actually do something, some kind of community service, or whether they came together simply for recreation, that we've seen the loss of those kinds of institutions. And churches are still there, but they may be one of the last sorts of things that's still doing that. Now, I'm sure that there are places where communities that those kinds of activities still go on, but it certainly has been observed that we have seen this kind of shift and that it probably affects everybody. And it sounds as if what we need to do is, in a sense, recreate some of those institutions. Or maybe they're there and they have just withered, and that what we need to do is go back and strengthen them. I'm not even sure what those institutions would be. Churches, I suppose, would be one of them, but I don't think we'd want to limit them exclusively to that. There must be a number of possibilities, things that particularly are there for young people.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that happens when we focus too much on deficits, when we focus too much on, we have a teen pregnancy problem, we have a gang violence problem, we have substance abuse problems that young people have, is that we create specialized programs that lead with services, that invite young people in to fix a particular thing that we think is broken. And they even may acknowledge that they need to have that be fixed. But what we know is that over time, if what happens is we wait until we see essentially the raw indicators of the lack of community, and we then respond to those indicators in a very narrow way. So let's say that those community institutions, and I'll define some of them in a minute, have slowly eroded over time, but the erosion has been relatively invisible. Nobody was watching because we weren't looking at that stuff. So the library hours have slowly cut back. We've cut back on the budgets for the recreation department. We've let the parks become dangerous places so young people don't play there anymore or go there anymore. The summer jobs and part-time jobs for young people have eroded so that they don't have enough things to do. Numerous things have happened over time that community sense has actually been weakened. Now, we haven't been paying attention. The signals have been there, but we don't capture data on it. It doesn't hit the front page of the newspaper, and so it doesn't happen. Eventually, what you see is bad things, bad data from kids, and we do notice that. So we notice that violence rates are going up, or that gangs are coming to town, or that the teen pregnancy rate is up, or that we now have a substance abuse problem in middle school. We get that kind of data, and we say, we have a problem. Let's respond to that problem with a program that is going to fix that thing. So we end up with a litany of little programs that are targeted, usually in a time-limited fashion, at young people to fix a particular problem. We don't go back and fix the things that eroded. We don't look to say, well, what happened to the fact that we don't have places, we don't just have normative places where young people can go, they can interact with people of other ages, they can figure out things to do that meet their interests, they can explore possibilities of what they could do in the future. We've lost that. We've lost that sense. Whether we saw those, again, in libraries, in rec departments, in young people being able to find a range of part-time and summer jobs so that they're meeting different adults, they're trying on different roles, the range of youth organizations, clearly the faith community is there. We don't have institutions of higher education reaching out into the community to offer young people opportunities to come on campus early and see what it looks like to go to college. Those things have been cut back in the name of whatever. One of the things that I did yesterday was to start this speech off, start off the lecture with a little 3-minute video clip of young people being interviewed who were coming out of summer school in Washington, D.C. They were being interviewed about the fact that the mayor had cut the summer jobs program. Now, if you happen to live in D.C., you know that the mayor cut the summer jobs program. This was years ago, but cut the summer jobs program to put more police on the streets. Now, you can figure out the dynamic there. We cut summer jobs. We don't have things for young people to do, but we have more police on the streets to wait for them to do something wrong. That's the pattern that we're in over and over again. We don't recognize the enormous normative value of making sure that young people have places to go, people to talk to that we want them to talk to, possibilities to explore that really build their skills and tap into their base of interests. We let those things erode, and then we come back and do things that sort of lock down or focus on services. And the young people understand this. So in 2 minutes, they just zoomed in on the problem and basically said, you know, the discussion about summer jobs was wrong. You all think about summer jobs as babysitting, things that you do to keep us out of trouble. If you really recognize that a summer job done well gives us an opportunity to try out new things, to learn new skills, to get into an environment that we hadn't been in before, you'd recognize that maybe we would have just done it for bus fare. We didn't have to necessarily be paid if it really was something that allowed us to move forward. And if you didn't have money to do summer jobs, you at least could have done things like organize basketball tournaments or recreational activities that it would have gotten young people from different parts of the city to come together to meet each other. Or you would have allowed us to do things. There's a great quote in this. A young person points across the street from the school to some boarded up housing, and he says, you know, look at that building. I mean, I'm not a carpenter, but young people working with adults could do something that we could fix up buildings like that. We could be useful. And the interviewer challenges him and says, you mean that you would actually be willing to work on a building for free? And that's hard work. And the young person thinks about it and he says, well, you know, I live in Northeast. If you ask me to fix up a house in Northwest, I might say pay me. But if you ask me to fix up a house on my block, where I thought a family in my neighborhood would benefit, I would be glad to help. Nobody's ever asked me to help. That's what we mean by that sense of community, by coming in to help young people have assets, build assets, think about how they really are integrated into community for what they can do right now as a way to build skills and show their worth. That's what's missing. And it isn't immediately replicated when we see a problem and then come in with a program and say, we're here to help you prevent doing bad things.
Mm-hmm. It sounds deceptively easy, but I'm sure that it's not that easy, and partly because it represents a completely different mindset, a completely different way of thinking about what the needs are, what the problems are, and how do we address them. How do you, and here I guess the challenge is for community leaders, particularly people who are in the political leadership, to get them also to think differently and to think about what role they could play in all of this would be. How do you get people to start thinking differently about the problem?
You've named it perfectly. What we talk about is exactly that, how we get people to think differently, to act differently, and then finally to act together, because that's mm-hmm. really this. And you've also nailed it that this is a leadership problem. Leadership meaning everything from political leaders down to community leaders and young people themselves. Starting at the ends is really the most powerful, although we have to start every place. One thing that clearly can help is getting young people to articulate this. They do it with passion. They do it with precision. They know exactly what's missing in their communities and in their lives, and they can tell you why even sometimes when we create a program for them, they don't go, because it missed the mark. So getting young people to be able to have an opportunity to articulate, not just at a one-time summit, but to really articulate what's there, what needs to be there, why they're using or not using what's available, and what they would really like to do to contribute as a piece of it. On the other side, it's absolutely critical that we engage the leadership, the folks who really not only control the resources, but decide on their priorities and decide how those resources are actually presented back to communities and back to young people. We do that through a series of things. The first is just language. We've stopped talking about problem. You know, we have to fix the youth problem. We come in and ask the question, isn't the community's job to ensure that every young person is ready for college, work, and life? And we call it Ready by 21. We picked 21 intentionally to get us beyond 18 because it's crystal clear that this doesn't stop at high school, that the community's job is not just to get a young person out of high school with a diploma, but to get them well into the next phase, whether that's into and coming out the other door of college or into their first set of jobs so that they're stable in a career. So we've picked 21 as sort of that next legal age to go after. Asking that question and then getting the community very quickly to give their own sense of how many young people are ready, giving them a basic definition of what ready is. What we do at the forum is to really synthesize research and use that. So lots of researchers come together to basically say, in their early 20s, a young person is ready if they're productive, and productive for a young adult means that they're either in college or working steadily or in the military, that they are healthy. That means physical health, healthy relationships, and healthy behaviors, managing risks, and that they are connected to something. They're volunteering, they're in a faith community, they're politically active, they're doing something that has them feeling that they are a part of that community. A pretty basic definition of what it means to be ready or what it means to be doing well as a young adult. But the research would suggest that only 4 out of 10 young people actually are doing well with that basic definition of doing well, and that 2 out of 10 are actually really doing poorly. They have a high school diploma or less, or they're on welfare, they're engaged in risky behaviors, or they're unhealthy, and they're at the point of being disconnected to that they're committing an illegal activity once a month. Opposite end. So we come in with a basic definition of a precise but manageable definition of what does it mean for young people to be ready and how many young people in this community are ready, get people at least motivated or embarrassed that with such a simple definition, we really can't say that most young people are ready, have them back up to say if you want them to be ready at 21, what needs to be in place when they're 5, 10, 15, 18, and is this community providing the supports across a set of outcome areas that allows young people to be ready and across a set of settings? So it's not just school. Naming the places that we really want to hold accountable for providing supports for young people, naming the supports that young people need to have, relationships, safety, structure, challenging experiences, opportunities for skill building, opportunities to contribute, positive, clear social norms, the things that young people need to have to be ready, and coming up with a common definition of quality so that we know what it looks like when we see it, and then really coming up with a map. Once we've found that we can get communities to have a common template of what they want to see for young people in terms of outcomes across the developmental years, what they want to see from the community in terms of supports, whether those are provided by the school, the rec department, a prevention program, or an employment program, and they can actually then sort of map the program and opportunities landscape in their community, and they find gaps. It's no longer now the young person's problem that they're not ready. We can see the connection between the fact that we're not offering anything for 13 to 18-year-olds to be civically engaged, but we wonder why they don't vote at the end. We can start to make those connections, and then the community can start to make plans. Not plans to start something massive, but plans to really connect the dots between small programs and opportunities that are available that different individuals have put in place but have not connected so that young people can see the connection, so that we can get people to think differently. We can get people to act differently to make sure that the things that they're doing, you may be passionate about pregnancy prevention, but make a connection between that program that you're running and the fact that if you really want young people to be inspired to not get pregnant, they need to be doing well in school, they need to think they have a job. Make those connections and look for the people that you can connect to in the community to help young people be able to find their pathways better. It is about thinking differently. It's also about using resources differently. And so behind that is also just a mapping of where dollars are flowing, public and private, because they're often flowing into the wrong places. Mm. So there's a series of things that we can help folks do, but it really does start with a common vision, common language, and some simple but common data, often backed up by young people and their families about what's actually out there.
Let me introduce again our guest. We're at our midpoint here in the Sound War of Focus 580, Karen Pittman. She is the executive director of the Forum for Youth Investment in Washington, D.C. She's here visiting the campus, gave a talk last night sponsored by the folks at the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program. She's authored three books, many articles on youth issues. She's a regular columnist with Youth Today. She's worked with a number of different organizations in her career, Urban Institute, Children's Defense Fund. She worked as director of the President's Crime Prevention Council. This was in the Clinton administration. She is a sociologist by her training. We're talking about things that can be done by communities to try to support young people and make it possible for them to grow up to be healthy, happy, productive citizens. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You know, I can imagine that people have high expectations of government and what government can be doing. But I can also imagine people in government, you know, say, imagine you're the mayor of the city and you have people who are turning up and saying to you, what are you going to do, Mr. Mayor, for, you know, to make it possible for the children in this community to succeed? And I can imagine the mayor, if he or she really, you know, could say what they wanted to say, they would turn to the people in the community and say, what am I going to do? What are you going to do? You know, there's only so much that I and the government can do. That if citizens aren't involved, and if community organizations, no, non-governmental organizations aren't involved, this isn't going to work. It just can't be a governmental thing. So that makes me think, well, what resources already are there in the community that could contribute to a solution to the kind of problem that we're talking about? And that maybe it's just a matter of, I don't know if they're not organized, or maybe they do. It is a matter of resources, and that they can only do so much with the kind of resources that they have.
It's both. It is absolutely the case, and I will say this with certainty about any community in the country, that we can get a better return on our current investments. Hmm. The things that we do are not only fragmented, half of them are unknown. I go into community after community where if we call a large enough table of people that, from a young person's perspective, are doing things that influence their lives, the youth employment people, the libraries, the school folks, et cetera, I can create a table in which people will routinely tell you they've never been together before. They've never tried to look at how the things that they're doing individually overlap. We have a slide that we put up that we actually call the scary slide. And it's a real mapping of when you look at programs that are coming out of, you know, sort of five public departments and you map them down into a family, you just get this massive picture of spaghetti coming down into a family. Hundreds of individual lines of things that were created that were well-meaning, but from a family's perspective or a young person's perspective are absolutely overwhelming if the expectation is that that family or that young person is going to be able to find all of those things that we've put together individually and be able to piece them together for themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, a well-functioning family is going to find it hard to do that. But to then expect that of a family that's sort of really on the edge is almost impossible. So to your question of, you know, what does the mayor say? Mayors are in a unique position, and they're recognizing this, to really play that leadership role, because it really is not only the correct answer, but in some ways a unique answer that they can say of, that's a good question. Let's figure out what the community can do, because really, I'm the mayor of the community. Let's call all of these stakeholders together, and let's come up with what I'm going to do as mayor is create a little office for child and youth development or youth and family development. I'm going to create something that is going to be the bridge, that's going to bring these departments together, that's going to bring public and private providers and parents and community leaders together for us to actually map the current resources that we have, to take a look at them to decide if we think they're adequate, if the picture, the real picture of what we have made through a set of individual decisions really matches the picture that we would create if we sat at the table and said, what do we want this community to look like for young people? What would we like them to find when they walk up and down our streets or they stop and go into something? What would we like to be there? The picture of the reality of what's there that has come together sort of by happenstance or by a lot of independent decisions is usually not the picture that we'd like. And so with those two pictures together, what we'd like to have and what we actually have, we can get community leaders together to say, we're going to make a commitment to change this picture, to make it not look like this, but look like this. And the answer isn't picking one thing in the picture and making it better. The answer is really figuring out who's most motivated and most able to work on a particular piece of the picture and asking them to do it in partnership with the rest of us. So this idea is not we need massive comprehensive programs, that coupled with the idea that we think young people need more supports, more of the time in more places, we make some mega department and give them the responsibility for doing it. It really is that we need those individual pieces, but we need those individual pieces to work in harmony and to work in recognition that they are only a piece of the whole and to neither overpromise or underpromise what they can do for young people.
Let's talk with someone who was listening here on our line number one, the caller's in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Ms. Pittman, I only picked this up by accident because I cannot abide listening to Rush Limbaugh. Nevertheless, I was intrigued very much by what you were suggesting, and I would like to ask a couple of questions. I think this topic is far more critical than the average person knows. I've taught school now in this local area for 3 decades. Many families are overwhelmed all but beyond redemption. And their children, of course, don't see anything positive. When our kids listen to various media outlets, they observe leaders, and I put leaders in quotes, whose behavior is at best questionable and indeed reprehensible. I don't think they see too many examples of group behavior that is cooperative in nature. I was just curious if you have seen these kinds of ideas, which sound fascinating to me, but require huge commitment, work in any places. I would like to see, I don't know what you would term it, a shadow student, maybe accompanying public figures to county board meetings. I do think that if well-meaning adults understood they were being observed and that their examples were being followed, you might actually see more cooperative behavior. I am so tired of hearing the notion that, oh, we are going to work without attention to politics, when in fact that is almost never true. Obviously, one would work through churches and schools, but those groups are totally overwhelmed at this point. We can barely even teach. So I would like to know, who attended the meeting last night? How many people? Was it a requirement for anyone? And are there local people who could serve, could help to serve as a bridge? And is there a community somewhere where this is being put into practice? And I'll hang up and listen, and I am entranced by what you're saying. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Well, thank you. You gave us a set of questions, and I'll try to answer as many as I can and can quickly. Last night, I'd say there were probably about 100 people in attendance from the university and from the community. By the questions that happened after the speech, I would say they really represented a range of folks from providers to even a couple of elected officials who were there. As far as your question of are there communities where this is happening, the answer is absolutely yes. And to your question of can this just be something that community organizations and the faith community does, they play a critical role, but you're absolutely right, and I'm in complete agreement. This has to be an issue that is recognized for its centrality by public officials. So at the forum, we really spend a lot of our time working with state and local public officials and educators and advocates and the business community to make sure that the centrality of this is understood. You're also right that when young people, whether they're looking at the media or they're just looking at what's in front of them, when they look at leadership as it's currently demonstrated, they see through it, and they would like to see very much a different kind of leadership. I'll direct you to Hampton, Virginia, which for the past 10 years has really been working with the idea that you said about young people being deeply engaged in politics and policy, not just a couple of them as sort of representatives that hang out in the mayor's office, but really using that as a focal point for deep youth engagement and having a series of pathways that get young people informed and ready to work with policymakers. It's one of the best examples that we've seen. They have a website that you can go to look at. But the result of that is very much what you've said. Young people there really do look at the business of government. They look at proposals that come out that affect young people and their families. They make recommendations on them. They are actively a part of the different departments, sitting on councils, and they are informed and trained and have done their homework enough that they really are changing that political landscape. I'll also point you to communities like, for example, Nashville, Tennessee, where young people in East Nashville, a very poor part of town, really organized themselves with adults helping. They really became the mobilizers for that community and took on issues that ranged from the schools and the fact that the schools were not only of poor quality, but the schools were not motivating students. Their expectations for students were so low that not only the high school graduation rate was low, but even those young people who graduated from high school were going on to college in very small numbers. They were able, by really doing their homework, working with parent and community leaders, to put this issue back in front of the school superintendent, put this issue back in front of the mayor, and make a series of changes, including changes in their community and getting this dialogue going, that they've been able over just a three or four year period to increase the college attendance rate of high school graduates from about 13% to over 40%, because young people were involved in this, but they were involved with leaders. And involved in moving public dollars. So I hope that answers some of your questions.
All right. And again, other questions are certainly welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580 with our guest, Karen Pittman. She's executive director of the Forum for Youth Investment. This has been around since 1998, an organization interested in promoting youth development and increasing the quality and quantity of youth investment and involvement in the United States. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess at the risk of going over ground we've been over before, it seems to me that still an important point is that here we have, in communities, we have different people in leadership positions and different organizations that all one way or another address community development or youth development. We have local government, we have the schools, we have the churches, we have maybe if it's in a community like this one, you actually have an institution of higher education, so you have this body of people who has done a lot of research and thinking about this. And then you have, you know, who knows, however many other kinds of organizations that one way or another deal with some small part. And I guess, again, what I hear you saying is that that's something has to happen to try to get all of those people together to recognize that there is a common goal and that the overall effect is going to be much more powerful if, in a sense, that there is some kind of unified effort, or at the very least, everybody gets together and recognizes, oh, here we're really all working toward the same thing. We may be doing it in different ways, but we're really all working toward the same thing.
Absolutely, that is the goal. That's the challenge, and it both sounds both easy and amazingly difficult. And we have to recognize basic things that we're dealing with: self-interest. We're dealing with the fact that you have programs and organizations and systems that are being held accountable for pieces of the elephant. And they're being held deeply accountable for one piece of that. And so there's a risk involved in having them basically step to the table and say, we'll be a partner in this larger thing. What we have to do is really very quickly help those organizations and entities identify that the common is bigger than their parts. They have to come to the table seeing that the piece that they are working on, and let's assume that folks that are doing this work really are passionate about what they're doing. They have to see that the piece that they're working on and that they are passionate about, not just accountable for, is not going to be lost in a bigger definition. I mean, this is really often one of the problems, especially for folks who are working with the population of young people that we would say is disadvantaged or vulnerable, et cetera. Those young people are often overlooked. And the people who work with them when they come to the table and we have this larger conversation about the community coming together to create a partnership for youth are often deeply suspicious that that partnership is going to give short shrift to the young people that are most in need. So we have to acknowledge that there are different populations of young people that we have to pay attention to. There are different age groups of young people, that there are different outcomes, there are different settings and services. What we need is a way to, as we would say, bring precision to the passion that we assume people have about making things better for young people. I don't think that people are going to show up voluntarily if they're not passionate about making a difference. People don't always feel that they're the most effective, and that's what's going to bring them to the table, but they are committed. And so finding a way to help them be more precise about what they're doing well, to help them let go of things that they're not doing well, but they honestly are doing because they thought nobody else could do it. And one of the things that brings people in these rooms and keeps them in the room is if we can very quickly get to the place where you almost have bartering going on, where you realize that you're working with young people and you started working with them on employment training, but you realize that they need counseling. You don't have qualified counselors, but you're trying to do the best that you can. You can come into a room and find that there's somebody 4 blocks down the road or 4 miles down the road who actually has the better capability to provide those services. You make a partnership. You agree that you're going to help the young people that they have in their neighborhood get what you have. And so these partnerships are happening and people are coming together because they're getting the tools to actually map that landscape of services and opportunities for young people, figure out honestly which ones they're doing well and which ones they aren't doing well, but not think that what that's going to do is have somebody say, well, you don't get to keep your funding because you're not doing a good job. We have to also develop a basis of trust that folks that are doing this work with young people and that young people who are doing this work for themselves and their communities are not going to lose by being honest about what they're doing.
Let's talk with someone else. This is a Champagne caller, line one. Hello.
Oh, well, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear this conversation. As the mother of two teenagers myself, they've complained a lot about there is nothing here in Champaign, Urbana for teenagers to do. Everything is geared towards the university students. And they also had a forum one day at Central High School where a policeman was telling them there was an alternative to violence. And they could walk away, they could do this and they could do that. And what this woman was on, what she's speaking of, Ms. Pittman is speaking of, what she has said that teenagers see a lot more than adults give them credit for. One of the things my son had made a comment about, well, the police said there's an alternative. What about their alternative? They've seen them beat the stuffing out of people. They've seen it not only on TV, they've seen it in real life. When they have an alternative, they can arrest someone. But they're telling young people when someone is messing with them and the school doesn't do anything, you know, you go to the school and you say, hey, look, this person is doing this or this, especially if they're an athlete, nothing is done. But when that child is forced to defend themselves, then the school has an answer. Let's arrest these kids. Let's hit them with fines. So you're saying that now we need to go back to how it used to be like back in the 70s. When I was a teenager, and there were programs for us to go back to it. So tell me what some of the solutions that we should be looking for, especially within the school system. And I thank you, and I'll get off the phone.
Well, thanks again for the call.
Thank you. And you raised a wonderful point. A lot of this really does, it does settle in things that are about changing at what we would even call the point of service, at changing the relationship and the interaction between youth and adults, especially adults of authority, of making sure that young people in their daily lives and in the places where they spend time, and clearly one of the main places they spend time is school. What you find young people saying is the place that they spend the most time is the place where they feel the least heard, that they can spend a lot of time in school, they can turn in assignments and answer questions, but the opportunity for the kind of dialogue that you just talked about is relatively rarely developed in school. Sometimes you'll find it in community organizations, et cetera. So this idea of really creating a place where young people can not just complain, but can actually honestly share their opinions about what they would like things to look like, how they would like to be treated, how they would like to be engaged in creating the rules. We've got examples around the country of where when you engage young people to help solve the problem, they don't disagree with the problem. They don't want violence in their schools. They don't want uncertainty on the streets. But when they can actually be engaged as problem solvers and helping to create the solution and enforce the solution, it's actually much more effective. So at the core of what you're raising is we're back to this issue of, are we really using young people as resources? Are we seeing them as people who really have a right to be a part of the conversations that are about them? And then are we not just giving them platitudes? There's an alternative, don't use drugs, don't do this, don't do that. But we know that nature abhors a vacuum. And so if you're telling young people not to do something, we have to be really very intentional about putting things out there that are alternatives, not just telling them that there might be alternatives, but creating those alternatives and making sure, as you said, that those alternatives exist and are supported by the range of adults who come into their lives.
We just have 2-3 minutes left, and this is probably a good place to try to be ending up, because I think we've talked a lot about the role of community leaders in developing programs for young people. But there's got to be some of the direction coming from the young people themselves, rather than us saying, here, we've created these great programs for you and they're going to be wonderful and here you go. That's not going to work, or at least it's not going to be as effective as a program where we got young people involved from the beginning and deciding, well, what is it that they do need? What was it that they think could help them? And getting them also involved in trying to have some direction in developing whatever it is that we do.
Absolutely. If you have the opportunity to look at how this happens in other countries, and I've had the luxury of being able to do that, let me just very quickly relay a conversation from young people in Latin America. And we had we thought it was a translation problem at first, because the young people kept saying, there needs to be space for us. And we were hearing that as like physical space, like we need a place to come. And then finally, one young person who actually spoke English as well as Spanish said, no, I'm not just talking about a place. I'm talking about space, as in everything that you do, you have to have created enough room and an assumption that young people are going to be in that space. It's sort of like having a chair at the dinner table, so that you notice. You don't wait until dessert to notice that your grandfather didn't come to dinner. You notice right away that you're missing an important person at your table. That's what they meant by space. They need that recognition that they should be a part of the problem. There's a wonderful quote, which I won't try to remember verbatim, from a young person who said, imagine the women's movement or the civil rights movement happening without women or African Americans being a part of it. How can you think that you're really going to transform things for young people without them being a part of it? Not just brought in to offer advice and then never know what's happening, but really be at that table and have space. And to your final point about where leadership comes in this, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that one of the things that's happened over the past couple of years is that as we have shared these ideas at the forum, folks in Illinois have picked them up. I mean, clearly I'm here. But Steve Guerra at the Department of Community Health and Prevention at a prevention conference that was held about 2 years ago really embraced this idea that we have to think and act differently, and brought these ideas into his department. And I think at this point they are really looking across the state to try to pilot these conversations in 4 or 5 communities. So we do have leadership here in Illinois at the state level trying to say, how do we bring all those people who are doing those different pieces of prevention together with people who are thinking about community and health, and orchestrate a different kind of conversation to create that vision and then figure out how these pieces fit together better. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're pretty much at the point of it here where we're going to have to wrap up, again with our thanks to Karen Pittman. She's Executive Director of the Forum for Youth Investment in Washington. If people would like to find out more about what the forum is all about, what would be the best way to?
Check out our website at forumfyi.org.
All right. Her visit here, sponsored by the folks in the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program. They're based in the Department of Human and Community Development here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We've had a number of their speakers on before, and I'm sure in the future we will, as they bring people to campus to talk about family issues. And we appreciate their making it possible for us to have Ms. Pittman here. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.